Before I begin, I need to tell you that this morning is not the traditional sermon. If anyone asks you what was the sermon about, if you look blank, that's okay, because it's a testimony instead. And normally, a testimony isn't necessary, particularly in a congregation, because over time, you hear stories from the pastor. But I have very limited time, as you know. And so I decided that I would share my testimony all in one fell swoop. So if it's TMI, I will tell you anyway. So let us bow our heads in prayer. O Lord, let the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Today is February 17th, the sixth Sunday of Epiphany. It is also my 69th birthday. The theme of the season of Epiphany is God manifesting God's self. How God makes himself known to us. That is what the season is about. And so today, that is why I am giving a personal testimony and telling you some ways that God has made himself known to me. First, I have to confess that I have always been envious of people who had real drama in their stories and could tell how God saved them from the jaws of destruction. Real first-person encounters. I've heard many testimonies. I've been on the edge of my seat. I've heard them and said, wow, what a testimony. That kind would really preach. But somehow my own story always seemed flat in comparison. I never drank, and so I wasn't cured of a drinking problem. I never did drugs, so God didn't break me of any addiction. I did, and I still do, bite my nails, but that vice somehow doesn't quite cut it as miracle material. So let's face it, my life was boring. Some pastors can tell very gripping stories about their call. Mine wasn't like that. I heard the call when I was 5 years old and said, sure, I'd be happy to. And that was it. No riveting sermon there. So then, as I was bemoaning my very lackluster testimony, it was almost as if I heard God saying, hello, have you forgotten? Have you forgotten what I did for you? And since I knew exactly what God was talking about, I thought, no, definitely not. But who wants to hear about a cure of mental illness? Addictions are one thing, but bipolar depression? Besides, maybe my story would create false hope in people. After all, if it could happen to me, why doesn't it happen to everyone? And then came another of God's questions. So, why should anyone testify about anything? Because, came God's answer, it's not about you, it's about me and what I do. So, here I am telling you about my own miracle. The way in which God made himself known to me 31 years ago. I remember it as if it were yesterday. Here's some background. All my life, I wanted to be smarter than what I was. After all, I had Deb Gilmartin as a younger sister. While she was reading Of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham, I was reading The Bobbsey Twins. Don't think I'm kidding. Once, after church, when she was in kindergarten, she said, "I will meet you at the conclusion of the service." I had no idea what conclusion meant. And I didn't find out until I went to my third grade teacher on Monday to ask her to define it to the class. You get the picture. It was very humbling to have a sister, a younger sister, who was smarter than I, particularly since she was 3 years my junior. So, as it happened, I developed a serious case of A-itis. I had to get A's, straight A's, to prove to myself that I could at least hold my own with my peers. Fast forward to seminary. Almost immediately, I fell in love, I mean that, with a brilliant first-year divinity student. And what amazed me was that he loved me back. I was crazy about him. I mean that too. With him, I could discuss theology, philosophy, metaphysics, and if I do say so myself, I sounded so smart. I said, "I'm saying this? Whoa." I was sure that a marriage was foreordained. I was preparing to be a Methodist minister. He was preparing to be a Methodist minister. What could be more perfect than that? God's plan, God's divine plan. That's what I thought until we were nearing the end of second semester. I was trying to make arrangements for how we would see each other over the summer. But I was surprised to hear him say, "Why don't we take a little break?" I thought, take a little break? Why? What for? And then he said, "Nothing final, nothing final." He assured me of that. Just a little time apart to give each other some space. Didn't sound good, but okay. So I somehow survived without him until fall. But once back at school, I sensed immediately that things were not good. And then I happened to overhear a telephone conversation which confirmed that my suspicions were correct. I had often heard the expression that God never gives you more than you can handle, but I never say that because in my case, it wasn't true. It was a crisis of my own creating. And yes, it was more than I could handle. I felt as if I were a pump organ. And without his pumping the bellows, I could no longer function. I had no place on which to stand. If he didn't love me, then how could I believe that anyone else ever could? How could I believe that my parents had, in fact, loved me? How could I ever believe that God did? So, in this existential crisis, I called for help in the only way I knew how. I tore up my room. I threw clothes. I flung papers. I threw my mattress off my bed. And by the time it was finished, it looked as if a cyclone had hit. My sweet mate correctly surmised that I had had a bad day. Exciting and manic hallucinations were to follow. And so my roommate called one of my teachers who happened to be a psychiatrist. And the next thing I knew, I was a passenger in his car riding to the psychiatric ward at Yale New Haven Hospital. I was shocked. Me? Mentally ill? Impossible, I thought. I may not be as smart as I like, but I am certainly not ill. I am not mentally ill. The doctors said I was. And after determining my diagnosis, I was then told that I would need to be in therapy and to take medication for the rest of my life. They identified me as having chronic manic depressive illness, which I was not happy to hear. And since they told me that my episode was triggered by my recent rejection in that relationship, I was sure that what had just happened was strictly a one-time occurrence. I knew in my heart of hearts it would not ever happen again. I was hospitalized for a month. I tried to return to classes right after that, showing I was not going to stay down for the punch. I was deathly afraid that if I took the rest of the semester off, I wouldn't find a place waiting for me in the fall. So I did not leave, but still I did not appreciate the fact that my eyesight was blurred, I could not concentrate on what I was reading, and I didn't like the looks of my shaking hands. Furthermore, I did not appreciate the fact that I had to walk around with a washcloth to catch my drool. That did nothing to help my public image. So, bottom line, I did end up going home to my mother's. Her curfew for me was as follows. You are not to go to bed before 7 p.m. And you are to get out of bed by 11 a.m. the next morning. That was tough. Hard to believe today because I am such a rooster. But that was the case then. My psychotic episode took me about a year from which to recover. And all the while, I felt as if I were wearing a big red R across my chest. R not for Ruth, but for reject. Whoever would want me now? Another man? Not. Everybody knew at seminary what had happened. How about the Board of Ordained Ministry of the United Methodist Church? I don't think so. The call that I had described earlier somehow felt as if it had been God's cruel joke. So I, like Elijah, cried out in despair, "It is enough, O Lord." And God, in response, asked me the same question God asked Elijah, "What are you doing?" And since I had no answer to that question, he, over time, sent me two angels. The first was in the guise of a very wise old pastor. I complained to him of my dismal fate, telling him that I had no future. And he told me two things that changed my life. First, he said that God's timing was not the same as mine. I had identified myself as a failure in part because my class was moving on without me. I would not be graduating when they did. I would not be graduating, maybe. I would not be going back. I didn't know. He said that I needed patience. Patience to wait for healing. And secondly, he said that when W-H-E-N, that was the life-saving word here. He said, when I began my work as a minister, I would discover that my depression had given me a more valuable education than I could ever learn from any books or any seminary course. And he told me that someday I would be grateful for what I had learned. Food for thought. Fast forward 10 years. Yale did accept me back. I did graduate, not with my class of 1978, but with the class of 1981. And in the meantime, I was diagnosed with a serious case of chronic fatigue syndrome. But much to my great chagrin and embarrassment, I had two more grisly hospitalizations at 3-year intervals. One being at Metropolitan State Hospital outside of Boston. Has anybody ever heard of that place? That's for hardcore. That was tough. I literally fought going there, so for 24 hours, I ended up in a cell-like room and got my food through a slot at the bottom of the door. That is hardcore. Again, the trigger of both episodes, each of which lasted a month in the psychiatric ward, was rejection. That's what got me in. And much as I loathe to admit it, it looked like the doctors were right. I was a lifer. Well, then God sent me my second angel, and you already know him because he's sitting right there. His name is Dick. In June of 1987, we had started dating. And things started to look serious right away. 2 weeks into the relationship, he asked me out for dinner. And before our friendship developed any further, I wanted him to know about my red letter R. So we went to a restaurant, and I started out by saying that what I was about to tell him would probably rule out marriage without a doubt. After the waitress brought the food to our table, I noticed that he was not taking a bite. I knew him well enough to know that was highly unusual behavior. Instead, he was listening to me for all he was worth. And it was worth hearing because I told him that I was a graduate of 3 loony bins. Hospitalization by hospitalization, I gave him all the grisly details, letting him know that he was sitting across from a lifelong basket case. When finally I ended this narration, I stopped. I noticed that he was white as a sheet, and he still had not lifted his fork. He just looked at me, and then he said, "Go on." And I said, "Go on? What do you mean, go on?" And he said, "You were going to tell me why we couldn't get married." And I said, "I just did." And he thought for a minute, and then he said words that I will never forget. He said, "If that's what comes with the package, I still want the package." And then he added, "Besides, if you get sick, I'll take you to the hospital. I'll visit you every day, and then I'll bring you home. But," he said, this is the testimony part, "once we get married, I will never reject you, and you will never get sick again." At the time, those words struck me as if they were a pronouncement of Jesus himself. It wasn't the same voice I was used to hearing. There was an authority. I was taken aback. I just heard the words and remembered them. They felt as profound as if I'd been a paralytic and Jesus had said to me, "Arise, take up your pallet and walk." And he's saying, "You will never be sick again." I'm sure that as we walked out of that restaurant together, leaving our full plates completely untouched, the waitress was probably wondering what was wrong with the food. Were we sick? No. I had never felt healthier in my life. All that happened 31 years ago. And since that time, I have had no hospitalizations, no medication, no therapy, and as to my diagnosis of bipolar depression, my medical records state "resolved" in capital letters. And now, these many years later, I still wear that red R, but it doesn't say "reject." It says "redeemed." And I thank God for that miracle in my life every single day. And so this morning I'm going to close with today's text from Psalm 116. This is my life's verse, which I used for my service of ordination. I love the Lord because he's heard my voice and my supplications. Because he inclined his ear to me. Therefore, I will call on him as long as I live. The snares of death encompassed me. The pangs of Sheol laid hold on me. I suffered distress and anguish. Then I called on the name of the Lord. Oh, Lord, I pray, save my life. Gracious is the Lord and righteous. Our God is merciful. The Lord protects the simple. When I was brought low, he saved me. Return, O my soul, to your rest, for the Lord has dealt bountifully with you. Amen.